This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
All right, again, it's the subject of freedom, and that's what we're interested in. But before we get into it, I want to talk a little bit by way of review about this idea of freedom. You know, freedom is a term that we use in a lot of different contexts in our culture. It means a lot of different things, and we think of political freedom, and we think of the freedom of choice, and we think about freedom of, as being a lot of different things. Biblically speaking, when we talk about freedom, we want to talk about the ability to choose, yes, but in terms of the productive use of freedom, the freedom to choose within the realm, within the sphere, as it were, of God's objective universal moral truths. And so where it is possible for people to choose against God's will for them, it's possible for us to violate God's design for us as people. And the Bible calls that sin. That's when we go outside. We use our freedom to go outside the range of what God has revealed to us. We have the freedom to do that, but we don't have the freedom to insulate ourselves from the consequences of that, and which is a real significant thing. And this is why when we look out at the world and we behold the kind of problems that people grapple with, maybe the problems that you're grappling with here tonight, that this is the consequence, according to the Bible, of each of us as individuals going our own way and traversing that boundary that God has set up to say, live within this. And so we may find ourselves in the name of freedom and choosing to go our own way and being our own guy or whatever, that actually the use of that freedom has brought upon us a real load, a real burden, that we are really not free at all. And maybe we've got some habits that we're dealing with in our lives, some ways of thinking, some attitudes, and that these things are really, we're finding, actually driving our life up on the rocks. And so it is when we think about the exercise of our freedom outside the constraints of God's moral will, that there is such a thing as right and wrong. Whether I believe it or you believe it or not, it is this way because there is a God who is moral and who is personal, and he has oriented and designed reality to work within the framework of who he is, within the context of his personality. And so freedom then, as the Bible describes it then, is within the bounds of God's revealed moral will. Then, but inside the realm of morality, there is an extensive level of freedom, and that God really wants us to seize hold in a deep way of the freedom that he does extend to us. And freedom will operate for us on many different levels. And what we'll find tonight as we get into our study is that really what God is about in our lives as believers in him is about the work of actually widening the scope of our own personal freedom. That's what God really wants for your life. He wants you to be increasingly free. Now, where we were at last week is we also made a point that within this area that we're free and within the realm of God's moral will are a lot of gray areas, areas that are matters of personal and individual conscience. And so we talked about the fact that in the political realm, you know, people who operate from the same principles biblically will sometimes arrive at very different conclusions politically or with respect to economics or various kinds of social values, war, things like that. And that's to be expected because these are not things that are just absolute and cut and dry. There are decisions that we need to make, and the way that we stack up various kinds of moral principles differ sometimes from person to person. And we should be able to have open and honest discourse about these things. When the church becomes absolutely monolithic in these areas, then I think we're in real trouble at that point. But then, too, we talk about matters of individual conscience that may arise from other things as well, like past experience. And the fact is that we are all, in varying ways, damaged goods. We've got real problems in our life that we have to deal with. And we may find that for conscience sake, there are some things that we would not say are absolutely right or wrong, but are areas of conscience for me that I could not practice without violating my own conscience, because it's just like kind of setting a set of dominoes down, and I know that if I take a step in this area, it's going to land me in a place that I do not want to be. And so some of the areas of excess, people are in this place. Alcohol and alcoholism, for instance, would fit into this category. More people than you may realize have real problems with gambling, for instance, and this type of thing. And so there are areas of personal conscience that are like that, and which we just need to understand that I may not be free in some areas where I may look at my brother or sister in Christ and say, well, they have that freedom and I don't. And when in Romans 14, when Paul is talking about these issues, he's saying four times, he says in Romans 14, he says, the thing that you need to do is resist the temptation to judge the other person. The person who takes liberty in an area that you don't feel that you have liberty in. They're not sinning necessarily at all. And so for you to set up your sort of arbitrary absolute, because I can't do this, no one should do this, well, then we've got real problems on our hands. That means that we are judging our brother or sister. Or similarly, another person who's got a conviction about some areas of their life. And we may look at that and say, you know, that's just really restrictive. I can't imagine living that way. And so we look to them and say, you know, there's just something wrong with you. And so we judge them like that. And we think of them as kind of sort of second-class citizens. Paul says, look, we have to respect what's right in the sight of all people. We have to be able to let people operate from the context of their own conscience. We can never coerce people into acting against their conscience. That would be a terrible thing to do. Instead, he says that we need to respect other people, to realize that people will, for conscience sake, follow maybe some guidelines for living that you or I may not be comfortable with. But in that context, we have to realize, Paul says, that they're seeking to please God with their life. And therefore, we should have respect for those differences and actually learn from them. And I shared last time about the experience that my wife and I had when we were living in Chicago and we were linked up with a small group of extremely conservative people, people that, you know, frankly, we just did not identify with in terms of lifestyle on a whole lot of points. But we had to look at them and realize, you know, they're really rigid and they're really structured, but man, do they really live for God? And we were challenged by that in the area of how they gave of their wealth, how they disciplined their own time so that they were regularly, personally interacting with God through prayer and through His Word and things like that. And so while I wouldn't get up at 4:30 in the morning with my friend to do his prayer thing and his Bible study, I did feel that, you know, what he was about was really important. That I didn't have any kind of habits whatsoever in this area, and I needed to develop them, so I'm thankful for that. Paul basically is saying, look, in these areas in which there is no absolute right or wrong, there needs to be open dialogue. Real principles are brought to bear, and we need to be able to have civil discussion about these things. And sometimes at the end of the day, just agree to disagree, and that's okay. That's fine. Now, this is an incomplete picture, and this is what we want to get into here tonight, is to realize that if all the issue was is that people have their conscience and, you know, I'm going to live my life slightly differently than the next person lives their life, and it's all about more or less, you know, what am I doing to live with a clear conscience before God, well, this would not be enough of an understanding of freedom to really capture the rich biblical view of what freedom is in the Christian life. Because there is another very important dimension to this, one that comes not from this passage, however, it comes from a related passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. So if you have your Bible with you, you might flip over there. If you don't, I brought mine with me. And here we are, we're in 1 Corinthians 9. This is the passage we're going to work out of. And from the New Living Translation, Paul says in verse 19, I'm not bound to obey people just because they pay me. Yet I have become a servant to everyone so that I might bring them to Christ. Now here, Paul lays out a principle. It's part of a much broader argument that he's been developing in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. But it bears on our discussion here because he's dealing here with the issue of what God has called him to do, namely the idea of mission and the idea of real Christian freedom, our liberty to make choices and to live life within that realm of objective morality that we described earlier. The point here, though, is, and we'll see how this kind of unpacks itself, is that personal spirituality, you know, matters of individual conscience, the things that I do in my life that may differ from the things that you do in your life, to help, you know, to cultivate and to facilitate that ongoing and deepening relationship with God. That's what I mean by personal spirituality and conscience, okay? But thinking about these things apart from missions, from mission is unbiblical, it's sub-biblical, it ends up being really just a matter of spiritual health and vitality, the nature of our freedom, really is this very private, individual act of personal piety. And there's more to that that needs to inform the way that we view our freedom. Paul, in this passage, is basically saying, look, I've got the freedom as an apostle, he says, to draw my living from my ministry. And he, in fact, in the first half of this chapter, lays out a variety of reasons for why that's appropriate and legitimate. But in his context, some people were raising questions about, oh, Paul, yeah, that guy. I'll bet he's just like those other sophists that are running around the Roman Empire, and they'll just say, you know, interesting things and draw people in and teach their ideas because it's profitable for them personally. And Paul was very aware that this very objection had been raised against him. And so in that context, that's what he means, that I'm not bound to obey people. Yeah, I'm not the slave of your conscience just because you pay me. Yet, he says, I've become the servant to everyone for the purpose of the thing that God's called me to. And so when our freedom stumbles weak people, a discussion that he picked up in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. These people from polytheistic backgrounds who were believing that if they ate meat that was dedicated to a temple, that they were actually practicing pagan worship. And as a consequence, Paul says, man, if they continue to eat with that understanding, then basically all their Christian faith is a fusion of their native superstitious animistic ideas that, you know, that nature is alive with the gods and so forth, and the biblical message. And that will destroy their Christian life. And as long as they have that understanding, that weaker brother, he says, ought not to be eating this meat because they cannot distinguish in their mind eating the meat because it's an act of worship versus eating the meat because it's a slab of flesh. And I'm hungry. So I will limit my freedom in that context, and I will limit my freedom if the use of my freedom brings unrighteous accusation against the work that my life is dedicated to, the reputation of God. And so he says, I will limit my freedom in that way. But as he goes on in this passage, you will see that what he's really developing here is the idea that far from a constraint on our freedom, that active love, real care and concern and moving towards other people produces radical freedom in our lives. And I think we view it as just the opposite in our culture. We think, well, real freedom is the absence of constraints. Real freedom is when I don't have to worry about anybody but me. But Paul is going to say, man, it is just the opposite. That the real heart of self-giving and sacrificial love for another person actually widens that gap, opens the door to a deep level of freedom that we could never have apart from that. Let's look at what Paul says. He goes on. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 20 now, he says, when I am with Jewish people, I become one of them so that I can bring them to Christ. When I'm with those who follow Jewish laws, I do the same even though I'm not subject to the law, so that I can bring them to Christ. And when I'm with the Gentiles who do not have the Jewish law, I fit in with them as much as I can. And in this way, I gain their confidence and bring them to Christ. But I do not discard the law of God. I obey the law of Christ. Yes, he says, concluding in verse 22, I try to find common ground with everyone so that I might bring them to Christ. This is one of the most revolutionary passages in the entire New Testament. It's really deep. And let's just unpack what Paul is saying. He says, first, you know, I'm able to... Paul was Jewish in his background. He was a trained Pharisee. He was one of the most educated men of his day. And so it would not be hard for him to say, when I'm with Jewish people, I become one of them, because in fact, he is one of them. But what's really radical for Paul is that when he says, when I'm with the Gentiles who don't have Jewish law, I fit in with them as much as possible too. And so what Paul is saying is that he has the freedom to identify with all kinds of people. That area of personal conscience that we talked about earlier, for him, was much smaller than it is for perhaps many of us. That he didn't feel roped in to a certain way of living, that the kind of living that God had called him to as a lover of people meant that whatever it meant to really honestly and authentically identify with people, that he was prepared to do that. How? Well, within the moral limits of God's moral law, like we talked about earlier. He's saying, I don't just identify with anyone completely. I still have the moral framework of God. I can't go past that in my relating to them. Even though he says, I'm not subject to their law or to the Jewish law. And he says of the Gentiles, he says, I'm not under any kind of moral system like Judaism had become. He says, but I don't discard the law of God. I obey the law of Christ, the law of love. And see, that's very different. And so in this way, Paul is able to demonstrate remarkable flexibility. This man, the man who 20 years before writing this letter would never have even considered the thought of entering into the presence of a Gentile household. For him, that would have just been unthinkable. It would have made him, by definition, ritually unclean, inaccessible to God, as long as he's under that pagan roof. And Paul has moved past that in a most remarkable way, so that he's able to engage and befriend and develop deep, deep bonds way outside of what he would have been comfortable with or what his conscience would have permitted him to do in the past. So that when he signs off on the letter of Romans, like he does so many of his letters, he's got a long list of people that he just deeply loves, has great intimate relationships with, and the vast majority of these people are Gentiles. So Paul can relate within the bounds of objective morality. Then there's the reason for why Paul makes this sometimes very difficult move out of what's comfortable for him and into the realm of what is appropriate in other people's culture. And the reason is that I can bring them to Christ. And he says that three times in this passage, what he really wants to do. The reason why he's able to set aside his own personal preferences, cultural preferences, and really re-examine those areas of conscience is because I want to find authentic, true common ground with other people so that there's not a huge distance to cover in their understanding this message and coming into a relationship with Christ. And so, that's a pretty deep thing. It's something that we really need to think about. For the sake of real communication, we need to hang on to and grow in this area of freedom. Here's what we're saying here. That we have this realm of objective morality, the red circle. We have this element of personal freedom in our lives. And the point that this passage, I think, is getting at is that Christian freedom means moving toward the culture, being increasingly free to move and live in our culture. How far? As far as possible within the moral limits of Scripture. Where we go, with whom we associate, what we're about. We ought to be growing in our freedom in these areas. The reality is that most Christians over time become narrower and narrower and narrower in what they're interested in what they're about, in where they're willing to go, with whom they're willing to associate with, and so on. We become less and less free. And Paul here is really painting a picture. You know, we've talked about the weaker brother who is unable to do some things because of their conscience. And there's a reason why Paul calls this person a weaker brother, because those weaknesses, those issues of conscience, constitute a real constraint on their ability to move effectively towards other people. Scriptural maturity, the kind of maturity that we read about in the Bible, always makes Christ more real to others, which means that we are moving in their realm, that we're extending our own freedom to get into their life and into their world, to set aside, you know, the odd stuff about ourselves that makes us who we are. Let's think about this just a little bit more systematically. Let's talk about the idea of cultural containment. By cultural containment, what I mean is that, you know, the church kind of establishes a certain kind of culture, doesn't it? Or subculture. And so you look out and you realize, you know, there is such a thing as church culture. And for some people, that's very inviting and they really like that. For the majority of people, it's kind of a big turnoff. But there is such a thing as church culture. There is such a thing, yes, as Xenos culture. And we need to examine these things in the light of this principle that Paul is laying out here. My wife and I, as many of you know, went to Asia last month. And we went to a few different countries, but we spent a significant hunk of time in a Southeast Asian country that is almost, well, it's 99.99% Muslim, at least in terms of the 35 million person ethnicity group on this major section of the country. This represents the 0.0001% of the population that have come to believe in Jesus Christ. Now, I want you to notice some things about this church. You've got the preacher up there dressed in 18th century Puritan Western garb. And then, I don't even know how to describe this. You have a scene above their little thing there of a very Midwestern looking house. Now, mind you, this country is 3 degrees off the equator. A cold day for them would still have a high of about 85 degrees. They've got a house with snow on it. Now, that's just bizarre. What were they thinking? Who are they talking to? What are they trying to make these people? Maybe there's a reason why there's only 0.0001 of them. That's very weird. What is it saying? It's saying something that we dare not ever say. It's saying that Christianity is defined in a particular cultural package, and that that package is defined in very narrow social terms. Think about the price that one of these people in this culture would have to pay for becoming a believer in Jesus Christ. They would have to embrace this. Becoming a Christian in the minds of people outside the Christian community means embracing a new subculture. And in my experience, for most, it's an undesirable thing. And so we really need to think about this issue. And why is it that Paul became all things to all people? Because we put blinders on. Because we become less and less aware of our freedom to express ourselves culturally. And more narrow as we kind of enter into this groupthink that's called subculture. Cultural distance today between the non-Christian world in America and the Christian world, without any doubt, is greater than it has ever been before. And Christianity has gone from sort of the cultural consensus, a strong positive, you know, in our culture, in our history, to more or less ambivalence over the last 40 years, to more or less strong negative, even hostility, in the from the point of view of non-Christians. And I'm just telling you, that's the way it is. Not always, and there are exceptions to that. But by and large, that's the case. Let's think about this. Let's think about the whole idea of identity and what we're asking people to do when we're asking them to come into a relationship with Christ. You know, who am I? That's a big thought, you know, and maybe it's conscious in our minds that we're trying to figure out who I am. Usually it's a lot more subtle than that, and it's just kind of in the background. It kind of drives us, but we're not always aware of it. But having a sense of self is very important. Knowing who I am, very important. And knowing who I am is almost always a function of the culture that we identify with. And so that provides us the banks, you know, for the stream of our life to move down. And so people do identify themselves in their cultural context. And that's a good thing. Culture's not bad. It just is, but it shapes and molds who we are. But it also molds what is for us a live option. And this is where now it begins to become an extremely important biblical issue for us. The question that we need to ask is, you know, is the Christian church, is our church, is your life the kind of thing that when people say, could I be one of them, could I be like you, it's just immediately dismissed as, well, of course not. Not interested. No thanks. Next topic. Let's talk about communication. Let's talk about noise, static, the things that impede effective communication from going on. Noise is the difference between the message sent and the message received. You know, so you get static on your phone line, and I'm having this, you know, conversation with you, and I'm, you know, pouring my heart out to you, and what are you hearing? You know, and, you know, I feel shattered because you haven't heard me. You know, the message didn't get through because all that noise was there. The message wasn't received in the way that it was sent. Well, that's, you know, because of the cultural dimensions here, that's where we stand in relation to our culture. The medium really does matter. How we communicate, how we choose to relate to people is fundamental to their ability to even hear what it is that we have to say. How many of these people in this Muslim country that I was talking about could show up to a building like this and say, that's God's message for me? The picture of Jesus, a white European male with blue eyes. You know, things like that. I'm not one of them. I would have to deny my very identity to be a part of them. I spent several years before I became a Christian interacting with Christians. You know, my older brother and sister were Christians, and they were always doing their Jesus thing on me and stuff. And you know, they would sit down with me and they'd say, you know, Jim, you know, God really loves you. And what I heard was, you know, you're really weird, uptight. You know, God sent his son into the world for you. And I heard, I can't imagine going to all those Bible studies like you do. All God's asking you to do, they would say, is just, you know, just cry out to God and say you want him in your life. All I heard was, join my church and be like me. You know, there's a difference between message sent and message received. And it's really important that we understand that and that we find ways of communicating that are going to take us way out of what's comfortable for us for the sake of being able to enter into their thought world. Stuff that gets in the way of effective communication is not neutral. It's very important. There's a lot riding on this. When Paul says, I've become all things to all people that I may by all means save some, he's implying that if I don't exercise the freedom to move into other people's worlds, to identify with them, to appreciate them, to communicate the gospel to them in terms that they can live with and be who they are, then I risk communicating in such a way that the message is lost, and they are lost. This is a very, very serious matter. We're called to radical freedom to identify with our culture. I want to just think about this from two perspectives. First, I want to think about it in terms of how did Jesus model radical freedom? You know, Jesus was a Jewish rabbi, lived, you know, in a conservative Jewish culture, very structured, you know, all this kind of thing. There's the in people, the out people, and so forth. But I'm reminded of the passage in Luke 19 where Jesus meets this guy named Zacchaeus. And it says here, this is Luke 19, starting in verse 1, it says that Jesus entered Jericho and he made his way through the town. And there was a man there named Zacchaeus, and he was one of the most influential Jews in the Roman tax collecting business. And he had become very rich. So we know some things then about this guy, Zacchaeus. And he tried to get a look at Jesus, but he was too short to see over the crowds. So he ran ahead and he climbed up a sycamore tree beside the road so he could watch from there. And when Jesus came by, Jesus looked up at Zacchaeus up in that tree. And he called to him by name. Zacchaeus, he said, come down quickly, for I must be a guest in your home today. And Zacchaeus quickly climbed down and took Jesus to his house in great excitement and joy. But the crowds, the culture that Jesus came from, the crowd that Zacchaeus could never fit into, the crowds were displeased. They said, He's gone to be the guest of a notorious sinner. And they grumbled. Notorious sinner. Yeah. This guy was rich, so he could do a lot, but he was completely ostracized from his culture because he was basically a traitor, a tax gatherer working for the Romans, collecting Roman taxes. But not just Roman taxes. He could collect as many taxes as he wanted under Roman armed protection. So these guys were really extortionists. And this man became rich at ripping off poor people. And so it would be very easy for us, I think, to look at that man with real moral indignation and say, hell was meant for guys like you. Wasn't a virtuous man. But he saw something in Jesus that he really desperately wanted. And that was good enough for Christ. And Jesus is going to have a meal, spend the evening at this guy's house. Can you imagine the kinds of stuff that would go on in his house? Rough business. Here's a guy who could never be married to a respectable Jewish girl. So how's he going to find female association and intimacy? Well, from other people outside the community, prostitutes, people like that. This must have been one hell of a party that Jesus went to. Okay? It wasn't the first time he went. But you know what? Jesus was excited to be on this guy's turf. Zacchaeus was excited to have Jesus over, and it was Jesus who initiated, I must have dinner with you. You gotta have me over, man. And so understanding freedom to move without judgment towards another person, to break out of the confines of my own cultural kind of molding. I mean, that is real freedom now to be able to truly enter into this guy's world in his turf, on his grounds. You know, there are lots of churches that put up their billboards on Sunday mornings and say, you know, everyone's welcome. And I believe that that's true. I believe they'd welcome anybody. But you know what? Hardly anyone's going to come. Why? Because that's not what non-Christian people do. They don't think, it's Sunday morning. I think I'll go to church. Well, some people do that, but that's increasingly unusual for those who are not habituated to that practice. No, it's got to be like Christ, Christian people moving out and meeting with people on their turf. That's where our freedom is going to pay off, in meeting people on their grounds. And you know, the fact is that Christians are often, I said usually, I said almost always, and then I erase it because I didn't want to offend anyone. But Christians are often one-dimensional, fearful, and boring. And that's a fact. And I am this way very often. And I have to lean against one-dimensionality. What am I really interested in? Well, I'm interested in the God stuff, you know. So that's what I read about. That's what I talk about. That's what I think about. And that's, you know, and in many people's minds who are not Christians, that's what a Christian is. It's somebody who's always wanting to bend your ear about Christ or the Bible or something like that. Very one-dimensional. Fearful. Lots of places that, I could never go there. I could never associate with them and so forth. And yes, dreadfully, dreadfully boring. I wish there was a boringometer that we could actually measure just how boring we really are. I suppose there probably are ways to measure that. But my guess is that you may think yourself to be an incredibly exciting person. But you may be one of the very few people who hold that opinion. But you know, Jesus was different than that. He wasn't your basic religious guy. Jesus was genuinely glad to be there at Zacchaeus' house. He wasn't holding his breath as he walked in the door, better not breathe in the noxious fumes, or saying, well, man, I've done my duty tonight. God, that was a drag. Man, Jesus wanted to be there. He enjoyed the company of this man. Did Jesus get drunk? No. Did Jesus drink? Almost certainly. He was referred to by the religious authorities as being a drunkard, a wine bibber. He was willing to risk that kind of reputation to associate and to identify and to live in the world of people who are alienated from God. He moved toward them. He enjoyed being in their presence. And, you know, we have to ask the question, what is normal to this person? Not what's normal to me. What's normal to you is very weird by other people's standards. And really, cultivating freedom means that what's normal to other people who are maybe very different than me becomes normal to me. And in that way, I've extended my freedom. I've broadened who I am, because it's a big enough sphere now that it can involve real relating and real identification with people who are very, very different than I am. What's normal to this person? That's the issue. I think that what that involves is a real active interest in new things. To relate to a person, to have something significant going on between the two of you, means that you enter not just into some deep, heavy thing, but that you enter into the realm of things that they enjoy. You know, maybe they're into some kind of sports or whatever that, you know, you don't really relate to. But you know, part of relating to them is actually cultivating and enjoying that sort of interest. It's not fakey. It's not like a chameleon. It's not plastic. It's authentic, real enjoyment of something that you never even had a category of before. You know, small talk precedes big talk. And I, because my interests tend to be very narrow, am a horrible conversationalist. Are you a horrible conversationalist? Do you find it difficult in interacting with another person that you don't know well, perhaps, to even know, you know, what the hell am I supposed to even say here? How does this thing called conversation get rolling? You know, what I want to do is talk about the big stuff, the heavy stuff, you know, the God stuff. Well, we're not going to get there most of the time unless we have an appreciation for the small stuff. Real interest in things that people in our culture are interested in. You know, the TV shows that people watch. Being able to engage in the things that just kind of shape and mold who they are. Those things ought to have an effect on us, too. We ought to have an opinion about those things. We ought to have a sense of appreciation for them. We ought to be able to chit-chat about that kind of stuff, because that is entering into their world. It's being on their turf. What demonstrates love and acceptance and warmth? Well, here I think this is an area that of communication. It's very important, because if you're going to trust what I have to say, you have to trust me as a person. And you won't trust me unless you perceive from me a certain amount of acceptance, of warmth, and so forth. And it's at this point, again, that I think some of us will have we find how just, you know, bound up and how unfree we really are. That the social uptightness prevents us from being able to have real situational flexibility and to really just kind of wholeheartedly enter in with people. But where we stand on that, I think, relates in a very important way to our own spiritual growth. Like, for instance, you know, I've been in a lot of different home groups that are kind of culturally different from group to group over the years. And I'm in one now where most of the women are huggers. And they start moving over like this, and I'm immediately like, ooh, You know, it's coming. Last Wednesday night, I had a friend over who was making fun of me. He came up, put his arms around me, and kissed me on the cheek. See, I'm a rigid person. And, you know, I'll like, you know, do the hug back. And then I'll walk away thinking, let's see, was that too soft and patronizing? Was that too, you know, forward and amorous? I don't know how to do this, you know. But I'm learning, see, I'm growing. Well, they may say otherwise. But, see, I've got to be able to interact, not because it feels good to me, but because that's what's appropriate to them, see. And in that situation, I need to be able to just swallow my uptightness and you know, kind of get into the moment. And I believe that this is a very exciting place to be. And we are all, you know, sort of here, if we're rubbing shoulders with anyone different than us, which I pray to God we are, because it is in learning to relate in the terms that other people really appreciate and feel acceptance from and warmth and love that we, you know, the scales of our uptightness fall to the side. We become broader people. We become people truly able to enter in with an increasingly wide spectrum of people. There is enormous freedom that comes with that. See what I'm saying? It's a great thing. The call to love is really a call to allow God to give you greater and greater and greater freedom in your life, to relate to people who are just different than you. All kinds of people. Paul was a tough dude, a strong man. And yet, you know, later in this passage in 1 Corinthians 9, well, actually in verse 21, Paul says, to the weak, I become weak so that I can win weak people. Well, what he means by that is that people who are beaten up and downtrodden are not people who he can't emotionally and psychologically relate to. That he can look at them and say, you know, not in a disingenuous kind of political way, but in a real way, I feel your pain. I know what you're going through. I know how you feel. And because I know that this message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, is the message that God has for you. I know it will make this life-transforming difference to you. So, the freedom then to move into another person's turf, into another person's world. And secondly, this comes from Hebrews chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. It's another element of freedom that's in some ways the flip side of that same coin. Here, the author says, continue to love each other with true Christian love. Don't forget to show hospitality to strangers. For he says, some who have done this have entertained angels without realizing it. And here's a reference back to a story that happened in Genesis. Well, that's an interesting piece here. The freedom that that mission requires, that real love requires, I think oftentimes involves the art, yes, the art of hospitality. And it is an art. The capacity to make people feel welcome in your environment. And not like they're making some quantum leap between, you know, where they're at and where you're at, but to feel welcomed, to feel comfortable. And I think that the basic principle here is that open doors. That as we express hospitality, as our home is a haven of refuge for all kinds of people, and people feel welcome in your presence and welcome in your environment, that just creates a level of trust and openness and real interest. And I think that this may be one of those areas, like the one we just talked about, that many of us here tonight are going to have to have some real progress made in our lives. You know, I believe after a lot of years now that other people's kids often don't seem like angels. And when my son brings home his cadre of thugs, I don't think, God, I'm in the presence of the supernatural here. You know, they stink. They're rude. They ravage our refrigerator. They trash our house. And I'm just so thankful they're there. See, because that affords me the freedom not to become a fossil. See, and to the ability to relate to young people, for them to be able to feel comfortable in my presence. No one calls me Mr. Leffel. I don't, you know, even our daughter's friends. You know, it's first name. It's comfortable. It's you're, of course you're welcome here. You know, I don't know who spent the night here last night, but I'm glad they're here. And that flexibility to just, you know, have a relationship, to accept one of these feckless teenagers for who they are, just gives you that, you know, you don't have to take yourself so seriously. And you understand what people deal with and what the culture is about in a deeper way. And these are relationships that maybe go absolutely nowhere spiritually. But 10 years down the line, there's going to be a category for a Christian family that loved them. And that will make a difference. I know that's true. I'm very interested in removing and reducing generational separation between myself and my children. You think that's going to happen by taking some kind of a class? Hey, this is what kids think these days. You think you're going to get that information from sitting your kid down and saying, so what are your friends telling you these days? I'm not going to tell you that. That's like against the schoolhouse rules. You get that information by interacting with your child, as your house is kind of the place to be. You spend some money. Fix up your basement. Let it get trashed. Because that's what's going to happen. But you're going to have the ability to work with your child. You're going to be able to see them interact. You're going to be able to teach lessons that are hands-on in that way. You're going to reduce generational separation from you and your own family. You've got to practice this kind of outward love, this going beyond my natural limits. It's the freedom that we get as well from fussing and material preoccupation. And so you do this. Maybe you fix up a spot there and you're going to say, you know, man, just having this here for the neighborhood, you know, and having relationships going and people coming and going, the revolving door thing's kind of fun. It does take a little bit of money on the outset. You know, we went out and bought a pool table and finished up our basement and stuff like that. You know, it was within weeks that we've got holes in our ceiling from darts that are thrown like this and, you know, blue holes in the wall. From cue sticks, you know, they're jousting, not playing pool, you know, stuff like this. And I remember, you know, the first time I went down, I thought, you know, I put many hours of work into this thing. And they've trashed it. They're not coming back. I'll teach them. You know, doesn't work like that, see. And what I had to learn is the freedom from fussing. And the freedom from material preoccupation, my stuff. You know, and so what if my carpet has to get, you know, shampooed a little more often or, you know, any number of things like this. And our culture, you know, we've kind of, especially, you know, for most of us who kind of come from this rarefied strata called the American upper middle class, you know, our images of what our home's supposed to be like comes from Better Homes and Garden and stuff like that, right? Well, if you're into people, and you're into open doors that open doors, stuff's going to get broken. It's going to get dirty. It's going to be messy. It's going to be inconvenient. And you are going to grow in your freedom through that kind of sacrifice. So there's a whole lot more that I think really should be and can be said about the relationship between real freedom and real growth in our lives. You know, because as we move towards other people, we just lose our hang-ups. We have to, for the sake of that relationship. We become increasingly free. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a good thing. It's God's thing. And let's pray that more and more this is your thing. Because God wants us to live free. And just in closing, this is a passage I think that is very explicitly directed to the Christian community, but I think it's important for us all to know, and maybe you're here tonight as a seeker, maybe you're just trying to think through this whole God thing. You need to understand on the authority of God's word that coming into a relationship with Christ is not a constraint on your freedom. It's an opportunity to become the very person that God created you to be. It's a beautiful thing. It's a good thing. Trust Christ with your hang-ups, with your failures, with your hurts. Say, God, you know, that's what the cross is all about. That death was the death that I deserve. It's the death that I'm headed towards apart from you, but I want to receive that for me. I want to have a relationship with you. I want to be alive to you. I want to experience the real freedom that comes with the Spirit. And the promise of Scripture is that if we approach God in this way, that He will respond to that, and He will give us His Spirit, and He will begin to really revolutionize our lives. It's a cool thing. Christianity is about freedom. Let's go ahead and pray. God, we're just so thankful that you loved the world so much that you came into it. And that had to have been a very foreign cross-cultural experience for you. We just realize that the path that you chose is the one that we need to choose too. And that in doing so, as we really break down barriers that alienate and separate us from people, and that as we take true delight in other people's lives, that you just increasingly do a work in our lives. We just become increasingly free of our hang-ups and the weird, quirky stuff that makes us who we are, so that we can take on new, weird, quirky stuff as well. But thanks for freedom. Thanks for that our personalities are fluid, that there is such a thing as real transforming growth, and that it's through this whole business here of really laying down our lives to love other people that we experience that freedom. Amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.